In the criminal justice system, the people are represented by two separate yet equally important groups. The police who investigate crime and the district attorneys who prosecute the offenders. This is the story of Donald Trump. His entire life, Trump has believed he's above the law, that no one would ever dare hold him accountable. He lies. He rips off workers. He sexually abuses women.
Hey, when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
He cheats in business. He cheated on his wife with a porn star and paid her off so the American people wouldn't find out during an election. But in the criminal justice system, ordinary Americans have had the courage to find him accountable time and time again.
Guilty.
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 Donald Trump guilty on all 34 felony counts.
For the first time in history, we have a convicted felon running for president. And to take on this case, we need a president who has spent her life prosecuting perpetrators like Donald Trump. He tried overturning Georgia's free and fair election.
I just want to find 11,780 votes.
He's tried to escape any responsibility for instigating the January 6th attack on our Capitol.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and I'll be there with you.
And if elected, Trump has promised to overturn laws that would keep him accountable and exact retribution on anyone he considers an enemy. Even warning of a bloodbath if he doesn't get his way. So we the people have a chance to render our own verdict on Donald Trump. We are the jury he most fears. When we vote this November, we vote for justice, accountability, and the rule of law that keeps America free.
Well, that sounds lively. Day one of the DNC.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Alrighty.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the broadcast as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, and Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX. Richmond, Virginia's WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR. Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM. Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for the broadcast, where it may be difficult to notice with everything going on, but voters in Alaska, Wyoming, and Florida voted in congressional primary elections on Tuesday. There is not a whole lot contested in those states, however, but we will share any noteworthy results or problem reports, etc., on our next broadcast. That's if, Desi Doyen.
Yeah.
If we can find the time for it, given everything else that's going on this week, including, of course, what is so far at least turning out to be one hell of a rollicking Democratic National Convention in Chicago.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
One that, frankly, I made the mistake of, I thought it was so clever in that I recorded day one of the full convention on C-SPAN, knowing that I wouldn't be able to see most of it live on Monday because a lot of it played while we were on the air, and then otherwise you know, getting the show out to our affiliate stations and so forth. So I figured I would watch it, you know, later. And of course, I thought I was being clever because I had it all recorded on C-SPAN. No commercials, no annoying commentary from talking heads in the media talking over everything. Even though, as it ended up being about 8 hours or more, it would allow me to fast forward through all of the boring bits, right?
That's the idea.
Well, I did that, but at least I tried to do that, but there was a lot more not boring bits than I had actually anticipated.
Surprise!
To be frank. So it kept me up all hours of the night by the time Joe Biden finished his Stemwinder keynote to close out day one, well after midnight on the East Coast, but it was even later out here by the time I was able to get to it on my recording. New York Times columnist Charles Blow described Biden's remarks as, quote, touching, as expected, although more of a defense of his record than an endorsement of his potential successor. He didn't so much pass the torch as set it ablaze and run a final lap, said Blow. On some level, that is his prerogative. That is the least that the party can give him, the option to finally bow with a bang. But I think that is not nearly generous enough, Mr. Blow.
I agree.
He both defended his record, not that it needs defending, frankly, and he was exceedingly generous, I thought, to Kamala Harris and to her contributions to his work over the past 4 years throughout. At least that's what I thought. And the record, along with Biden's speech, is a long one, with lots of high points and a list of accomplishments so long, frankly, that I had forgotten many of them until he listed them, including a number of accomplishments that, frankly, would have been considered the highlight of most presidential administrations, but they were sort of relegated to, oh, yeah, I forgot about that one.
True.
That's this administration, given the extraordinary record that I think may take some years before Americans and even historians truly come to appreciate it. So, so say what you will about how old Joe Biden now is. And yeah, that happens when you're 81 years old after a life like this. But I have long maintained, and I will continue to do so, that his will be regarded as one of the most effective administrations in American history. And that's true whether you love Joe Biden or hate Joe Biden. And it's true whether our corporate media, our corporate mainstream media, has made any of that clear to the American people yet or not. Apparently, most of them, the corporate mainstream media, and I didn't actually realize this because I was watching on my own time until the early hours of the morning on my own C-SPAN fast-forwarding schedule. Apparently, most of the media were feigning outrage that the evening was running so far behind, largely due to extended applause breaks insisted upon by the convention goers, that it all pushed the start of the president's remarks well beyond prime time and into the 11:30 p.m. Eastern time hour, I guess, and the speech then did not complete until after midnight on Monday night into Tuesday morning, apparently for folks on the East Coast. Sorry for the inconvenience, corporate media outlets.
Yeah, you know, the DNC is not supposed to be a show for the media. It's supposed to be a gathering of Democrats to celebrate themselves and what they plan on doing.
Well, it's supposed to be a show for the American people, at least. And it's true that, you know, a lot of the American people probably gave up and went to bed, but too late. Too bad. Anyway, Biden's remarks ran later into the evening thanks to, I think, 4.5-minute ovation before he even got out his first word. And then those were punctuated with still more ovations throughout, just as Hillary Clinton's remarks were also, held up throughout with ovations. Her remarks also likely ran over the time, given the reception from convention goers, including, by the way, a lengthy lock him up chant, which, though Hillary tried to avoid, in fact, she couldn't. Though really, why would she want to at this point? The Times' Jane Costin quipped, quote, "If you could bottle whatever Clinton must have been feeling, listening to a chanting crowd screaming, lock him up, it would power a nation." It just might. Power them to the ballot box in any event this November. As to what will actually be needed to actually power the nation, well, we'll get to that in our latest Green News report with Desi Doyen a little bit later. I'll try to also share a few clips from day one of the DNC in a bit today, as time allows, and we'll discuss both days one and two when Barack Obama is set to be the keynoter. That should also be a stem winder. In any event, we will cover both of those days with roundtable special coverage on our next broadcast. Please forgive me if I cut the Dems love fest, I guess, short for the moment, because I at least need to keep my eyes, as ever, on the ballot box, on the track conditions on which the horses are racing this November 5th, and as discussed much of late, likely beyond November 5th. In most of the major polling averages of late in the horse race, Kamala Harris now appears to be leading Donald Trump nationally by, let's call it, 2 points or so, give or take, in most of those polling averages. She's largely out in front in most of the battleground polls of the blue wall states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania for the moment. And she's gaining ground or even overtaking Trump in the so-called Sun Belt battleground states like Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, and Nevada. Some respectable polls of those states now, in fact, show Harris leading Trump among likely voters in both Arizona and North Carolina, if you can believe it. But it's far safer at this point, I think, to presume that all of those states, particularly those like Arizona and Georgia, will in fact be very, very close, as they were in 2020. So the track conditions in those states where those horses are running are particularly important this year. With that in mind, we are about to see, and we will do our best to cover, what I think is an unprecedented push, at least in modern times, to game the electoral system by, in this case, the Republican Party, in states and counties and towns and even precincts across the country. This is, by and large, what Republicans are choosing to do to try to, you know, quote unquote, win this year's presidential election, as well as to win majorities in both chambers of Congress and as many state and local seats as they can also possibly take. They are choosing to try and win by suppressing the vote any way that they can, rather than, you know, offering positive, likable candidates and positive policies that Americans actually like and actually want to vote for. In fact, the issues of note in this election are, by and large, ones that Democrats win among voters in polls by huge margins. We discussed it a little bit in one of our shows last week, I think. It is the progressive policies, whether they are labeled as such or not, which are the popular policies right now in this country. From guaranteeing abortion rights to gun safety regulations to increases in the minimum wage to bringing back manufacturing to the U.S. to developing clean, renewable energy to allowing the huge Trump tax cuts for the wealthy and the corporations to expire, to negotiating with big pharmaceutical companies, to radically lowering the cost of prescription drugs to save billions of dollars for both the federal government and, yes, for consumers. In the case of lowered prescription prices for Medicare, lowered costs for American senior citizens, and yes, even to efforts to improve border security as agreed to between the Biden-Harris administration and Republicans in the U.S. Senate, at least until Donald Trump ordered House Republicans to kill that landmark bill because he wanted to maintain his claims about a border crisis as an election issue, perhaps the only issue that he has figured out how to run on this year at all. So, unable to run with popular policy positions on all of those things and more, Republicans are simply now trying to game the electoral system itself instead, to prevent certain people from being able to cast their votes at all, or to prevent their votes from being counted as cast and certified if they do. There's all sorts of variations on this theme underway this year, and particularly in the most critical battleground states, like the great state of Arizona, where Republicans have quietly been renewing an effort that they have been pushing for some 20 years now to simply keep a huge number of Arizona voters from being able to vote in the presidential election at all this year. And this week, they're hoping for a helping hand from Donald Trump's corrupted, packed, and stolen U.S. Supreme Court majority. As the LA Times detailed on Monday, the Republican National Committee is urging the Supreme Court to intervene in an Arizona election dispute and block up to 40,000 of the state's registered voters from casting ballots in the presidential race. 40,000 voters they are hoping to suppress. In a state where Joe Biden won the presidential election 4 years ago by just over 10,000 votes. Republican state lawmakers charged that these voters, these 40,000, did not provide proof of their citizenship when they were registered and therefore now must be barred from voting either in person or by mail. Now, if some of this is beginning to sound familiar to you, it's because Arizona Republicans have been waging this fight now for decades, over and over again, each time hoping that they will find a court that's more favorable to their voter suppression scheme. At issue is a long-running dispute in Arizona over whether voters must furnish proof of their citizenship when they register to vote. In 1993, the U.S. Congress sought to make it easier to register. The National Voter Registration Act, commonly known as the Motor Voter Law, allowed prospective voters to fill out a simple form to register anywhere in the country, to register to vote, and sign a sworn statement that those using that National Voter Registration Form were, in fact, U.S. citizens. Voter registration forms in most states work similarly. One simply checks a box stating that, yes, they are a U.S. citizen under penalty of law for lying. And after presenting ID, proving they are who they say they are, that part, by the way, is federal law already in all 50 states, in case Republicans have led you to believe otherwise. But after that, then they are now registered to vote wherever they live. But a number of states with a history of voter suppression have made it more difficult to register to vote over the years. So the national form available for use to anyone in any state was created and it was made available by an act of Congress in 1993, and it has worked without a problem ever since. Nonetheless, in 2004, when Arizona, by and large, was completely run by Republicans, the state passed a law that newly registered voters had to provide, quote, documentary proof of citizenship. The ACLU and civil rights advocates sued to challenge that requirement. They cited estimates that more than 13 million Americans lacked access to a birth certificate or another document to prove their citizenship, even though they were most definitely American citizens. 13 million. So the voting rights advocates won that contest in the lower courts, and the Supreme Court ruled, and they agreed, in 2013 that the federal motor voter law preempted or overrode the Arizona law requiring proof of citizenship. In fact, it was no one less far right than Justice Antonin Scalia who spoke for the 7-2 majority on the Supreme Court and said that the federal law requires states to, quote, accept and use the standard federal form, at least in federal elections. So votes for federal office like president. In response, Arizona adopted an unprecedented two-track system of voter registrations. It wasn't enough that the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, yeah, that's fine. That's the law passed by Congress that if they're registered on the national form, then they're registered to vote in the state. No. Arizona said, all right, we will have two separate tracks to vote in state and local elections. New registrants were required to show proof of their citizenship. Under Arizona law, with a driver's license or a birth certificate, The high court had allowed the state to suppress the vote at the state and local level, apparently, just not at the federal level. Those who registered through the federal form without providing proof of citizenship were allowed to vote only in federal elections in Arizona. They're referred to in Arizona as federal-only voters. The state later agreed in 2018 in a consent decree to give full registration to new voters whose residence and citizenship could be, in fact, confirmed through the Motor Vehicles Department database. In other words, if the person who had registered with the federal form didn't supply documentation of citizenship, well, if the state was able to determine that the person was, in fact, a U.S. citizen with their own copious records that they keep on people, then, in fact, the voter would be allowed to vote in all elections, state, local, and federal, under this agreement, finally, in 2018. But 2 years ago, the Republican-controlled legislature passed a new law that prohibits registered voters who do not provide proof of citizenship from voting either by mail or in a presidential election. So they're trying to do the whole damn thing all over again. The Department of Justice sued to challenge those laws, and after a 10-day trial, U.S. District Judge Susan Bolton in Phoenix blocked enforcement of that Republican state legislature's law, their new proof of citizenship requirement. The judge cited the federal motor voter law of 1993 once again and the state's 2018 consent decree when they pretended that they were going to go along with this. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, by a 2-1 vote, refused to lift the order from the lower court at the beginning of this month, on August 1. And then a week later, the RNC, joined by the two GOP leaders of the Arizona legislature, so the Republican National Party and the two Republican leaders in the Arizona state legislature, they went to the Supreme Court and urged the court to set aside Judge Bolton's ruling to the extent that it would allow voters, quote, allow voters who have not provided documentary proof of citizenship to cast ballots for president or by mail. So they are stopping at nothing. And the hope is to prevent some 40,000 voters from being able to cast their vote in about 2 months' time. The Republicans also argued that a federal judge should not be allowed to make a late change in the state's election rules. That's the U.S. Supreme Court has long cited something, their so-called Purcell principle, holding that even if a change in the law would allow more access for voters or fairer voting rules, they should not be implemented at the last minute just before an election in order to avoid confusion about voters and election officials. Mind you, the high court has used that Purcell principle often when they want to allow voter suppression, or they ignore the Purcell principle, and you know, when if it's a separate matter. But here, Arizona Republicans are charging that if those voters who were long ago allowed to vote under all of the, you know, the court orders and the consent decrees, et cetera, that that would somehow be changing the law at the last minute impermissibly too close to an actual election. That's the argument they're actually making. And with this court, who knows? Danielle Lang, a voting rights attorney for the Campaign Legal Center who worked on the case, said she found that argument to be surprising. She told the LA Times, quote, they are trying to upend the law as it has been in Arizona since at least 2018. The voters who registered using the federal form were not asked to provide proof of citizenship. In other words, it's the Republicans who are trying to change the law at the last second. And if you want to cite the Purcell principle to prevent that from happening, well, then we should leave the status quo, which is all of those voters should be allowed to vote this November. Danielle Lang went on to note that the Republican lawmakers and their attorneys who brought the case, quote, didn't cite a single example of a non-citizen who was enrolled under this program, not one. She said, why would someone who is not a citizen try to register? She said, it's a felony, and it would get you deported just to cast one ballot. That's why it doesn't happen. But even though Congress made it easier for Americans to register to vote back in 1993, those federal rules cannot override, quote, the Arizona legislature's sovereign authority to determine the qualification of voters and structure participation in its elections. That's what they said in their emergency appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court filed on August 9th, just days ago. And yes, it's virtually the same argument that they have made over and over and over again for decades, losing each time. But this time, it seems, they must believe they got friends on the high court willing to ignore precedent and reason and years of court rulings and consent decrees to allow some 40,000 Arizona voters to simply be purged from the rolls just weeks before an election in perhaps the nation's most critical ever presidential election in one of the most important battleground states. So the Arizona Republicans have sought a fast-track appeal. They're asking for a decision by this week, this Thursday, I believe it is, because counties will soon have to begin printing ballots. The way the court responds here may signal whether this corrupted court is now ready to intervene in partisan election disputes like this. Arizona's Democratic Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, previously a guest on this program while he served as the chief election official in Arizona's Maricopa County, that's Phoenix, he argued that the appeal should be rejected. In a statement, he noted, quote, there is no evidence of fraud and undocumented voting. The 2024 election is weeks away, and acting now to restrict the voting rights of a large group of Arizona's voters is undemocratic, he said, adding that many of the affected voters are service members and students and Native Americans who did not have birth certificates while registering. Last Friday, Biden administration lawyers also urged the court to turn down this appeal. Solicitor General Elizabeth Preliger said that, quote, thousands of voters have already registered to vote by filling the federal form without accompanying documentary proof of citizenship. Judicial intervention at this stage would produce unnecessary confusion and chaos on the cusp of an election. Especially, once again, in Arizona, one of the handful of battleground states that could decide who wins the White House this year after President Biden very narrowly won the state back in 2020 by just 10,457 votes. And remember, the Arizona Secretary of State's office last week said that 41,128 registered voters in Arizona could be affected by whatever the court rules here. Is there any evidence that any of them unlawfully registered to vote as non-citizens? No, there is not. There is none. Zero. Republicans have shown no evidence that any of those 40,000-plus registered voters in Arizona have ever violated the law by either registering to vote or voting as non-citizens. But because Republicans know that their policy positions are wildly unpopular policy decisions on damn near everything right now, they are, they're not fighting to win voters. They are fighting to lose voters from the voting rolls any way that they possibly can.
Wow. If you are in Arizona or you know anybody in Arizona, spread the word. Let them know what's going on.
So the question now is, will this corrupted Supreme Court be willing to help them, purge 40,000 voters just before Election Day? On this case and many others that are likely to come before the court between now and November 5th, and as troubling, after November 5th, when you can expect legal shenanigans and maneuvers from Republicans to try and steal their way to the White House if they are unable to do it the old-fashioned way by legitimately winning the number of electors, 270 of them, needed to win the presidency. Well, we will see what the Supreme Court is or isn't willing to do in the days ahead. Just thought you ought to know. All right, let's take a quick break. We will come back with a few sound bites from day one of the DNC in Chicago and Desi Doyen's latest Green News report. That is still ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Let's work together, people. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Democrats seem to be working together in a raucous, joyful, and really there's no other way to put it, joyful celebratory day one of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago on Monday night. It was a veritable roster of Democratic all-stars, both old-timers and up-and-comers, who kept me up far beyond my bedtime last night, as I'd hoped to fast forward through the dull parts, but I did not find all that many dull parts,
yeah,
to be honest.
Yeah, very interesting. I have to agree.
And there were surprises throughout, such as when Democratic nominee Kamala Harris, who was not scheduled to take the stage until her formal acceptance speech on Thursday night. Well, she showed up early to preview what would become a figurative passing of the torch with President Joe Biden's speech at the end of the night.
It is so good to be with everyone this evening in this hall and everyone at home. This is going to be a great week. And I want to kick us off by celebrating our incredible President Joe Biden, who will be speaking later tonight. Joe, thank you for your historic leadership, for your lifetime of service to our nation, and for all you will continue to do. We are forever grateful to you. Thank you, Joe. And looking out at everyone tonight, I see the beauty of our great nation, people from every corner of our country and every walk of life are here, united by our shared vision for the future of our country. And this November, we will come together and declare with one voice, as one people, we are moving forward. With optimism, hope, and faith, so guided by our love of country, knowing we all have so much more in common than what separates us, let us fight for the ideals we hold dear, and let us always remember, when we fight, we win. God bless you. God bless the United States of America. Good night, everyone.
So the Democratic National Convention on its first night showcased speeches from both the last Democrat to lose to Donald Trump and the last one to beat him. But before either Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden would take the stage on Monday night, thousands of marchers churned through Chicago streets protesting U.S. support for Israel during the war in Gaza. While some 20 to 30,000 protesters were promised by the organizers, the crowd of protesters was actually notably smaller than that, but at an estimated 6,000 or so, it's still worth taking note of.
Definitely.
In the convention hall, however, the issue went largely unmentioned for most of the night by most of the speakers, at least until Joe Biden got to the microphone. Though New York's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who frankly just brought the house down in her primetime remarks, as did freshman Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett of Texas, by the way. But AOC got cheers when she praised Kamala Harris for working, quote, tirelessly to get a ceasefire in Gaza and get the hostages home. Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia also made a brief allusion to the conflict in his stirring remarks.
I'm convinced tonight that we can heal sick bodies. We can heal the wounds that divide us. We can heal a planet in peril. We can heal the land. And in a strange way, the pandemic taught us how. A contagious airborne disease means that I have a personal stake in the health of my neighbor. If she's sick, I may get sick also. Her health care is good for my health. I'm just trying to tell you that we are as close in our humanity as a cough. I need my neighbor's children to be okay so that my children will be okay. I need all of my neighbor's children to be okay. Poor inner city children in Atlanta and poor children of Appalachia. I need the poor children of Israel and the poor children of Gaza. I need Israelis and Palestinians. I need those in the Congo, those in Haiti, those in Ukraine. I need American children on both sides of the track to be okay. Because we are all God's children. And so let's stand together. Let's work together. Let's organize together. Let's pray together. Let's stand together. Let's heal the land. God bless you. Keep the faith.
Reverend yes. Warnock. You know, he's a minister, so of course he is living Love Thy Neighbor.
A handful of delegates who ran on an uncommitted ticket protesting Biden's position on the war unfurled a banner during his speech that read, Stop Arming Israel. That was blocked by supporters waving Biden signs before it was wrestled away and the lights over that section of the audience went off. Biden himself addressed the issue of Israel and Gaza, however, head on during his nearly 50-minute stem winder that ran until after midnight, saying he'd keep working to, quote, end the war in Gaza and bring peace and security to the Middle East, before recognizing the protesters outside of the United Center.
And we'll keep working to bring hostages home and end the war in Gaza and bring peace and security to the Middle East. As you know, I wrote a peace treaty for Gaza. A few days ago, I put forward a proposal that brought us closer to doing that than we've done since October 7th. We're working around the clock, my Secretary of State, to prevent a wider war and reunite hostages with their families and surge humanitarian health and food assistance into Gaza now. To end the civilian suffering of the Palestinian people and finally deliver a ceasefire and end this war. Those protesters out in the street, they have a point. A lot of innocent people are being killed on both sides.
You heard the president pounding on the podium there to end this war. The crowd cheered, and for a moment, as AP describes it, the war did not seem like it was dividing the party at all. For the moment, in any event.
And speaking of AOC, who I mentioned, who frankly just killed on Monday night.
Yes, she did.
During her remarks, we were focused on why she believes the party must get behind Kamala Harris as a champion for the working class.
I see a leader with a real commitment to a better future for working families. And Chicago, we have to help her win. Because we know that Donald Trump would sell this country for a dollar if it meant lining his own pockets and greasing the palms of his Wall Street friends. And I, for one, am tired of hearing about how a two-bit union buster thinks of himself as more of a patriot than the woman who fights every single day to lift working people out from under the boots of greed, trampling on our way of life.
Well, that was lively. Speaking of labor unions and union busters like Donald Trump, who recently lauded Elon Musk for threatening to fire workers who were attempting to organize. By the way, that's a violation of federal law. During the afternoon session, one union president after another were featured, highlighting and explaining the reasons for their endorsements of the Harris-Walz ticket. But United Auto Workers President Sean Fain, who leads the Million Strong Auto Workers Collective, he was held for a primetime slot in which he talked about Joe Biden visiting a UAW picket line last year. And when auto workers struck back in 2019, it was Kamala Harris at the time, not Donald Trump, who walked the picket lines with the striking workers. Quote, Donald Trump is all talk and Kamala Harris walks the walk, Fain said, before once again repeating what has quickly become a bit of a trademark phrase when referring to the disgraced former president and businessman.
So for us in the labor movement, it's real simple. Kamala Harris is one of us. She's a fighter for the working class. And Donald Trump is a scab.
And the crowd repeating, Trump's a scab.
With enthusiasm.
Since I mentioned Texas freshman Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett's star turn during the primetime session on Monday, here's what the young, if two-decade-long public defender had to say about the matchup between Harris and Trump this November.
On November 5th, our nation will hire a president, a commander-in-chief, and leader of the free world. So let's compare their resumes, shall we? She became a career prosecutor while he became a career criminal. With 34 felonies, 2 impeachments, and 1 porn star to prove it. She's lived the American dream while he's been America's nightmare.
Jasmine Crockett of Texas. Hillary Clinton was greeted with wild and sustained applause that lasted for more than 2 minutes before she was finally able to quiet the crowd. She delivered a fiery speech, hoping that Kamala Harris would do what she could not, become the first woman president of the United States by beating Donald Trump. Clinton evoked her 2016 concession speech by referencing all of the, quote, cracks in the glass ceiling that she and her voters had achieved, along with the woman who paved the way, the women who paved the way for both of them in years prior.
In 1972, a fearless black congresswoman named Shirley Chisholm president. And her determination let me and millions of others dream bigger, not just because of who she was, but because of who she fought for. Working parents, poor children, the last, the least, and the lost. In 1984, I brought my daughter to see Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman nominated for vice president. If we can do this, Jerry said, we can do anything. And then there was 2016, when it was the honor of my life to accept our party's nomination for president. And nearly 66 million Americans voted for a future where there are no ceilings on our dreams. And afterwards, we refused to give up on America. Millions marched, many ran for office. We kept our eyes on the future. Well, my friends, the future is here. I wish my mother and Kamala's mother could see us. They would say, keep going. Shirley and Jerry would say, keep going. Women, women fighting for reproductive health care are saying, keep going. Families building better lives. Parents stretching to afford childcare, young people struggling to pay the rent. They're all asking us to keep going. So, with faith in each other and joy in our hearts, let's send Kamala Harris and Tim Walz to the White House.
Hillary Clinton at the DNC in Chicago on the first night. But it was President Joe Biden who closed the night with a rip-roaring stemwinder of a speech after his patriotic decision to step aside this year to make room for Kamala Harris to take over at the top of the ticket, who he lauded throughout his remarks as he detailed his extraordinary successes as president, which took a while in and of itself, while at the same time vowing to be the top volunteer worker for the Kamala Harris and Tim Walz ticket, as he closed on a sentimental note after a 52-year career in the U.S. Senate and the White House.
Folks, all of us carry a special obligation. Independents, Republicans, Democrats, we saved democracy in 2020, and now we must save it again in 2024. The vote of each of us cast this year will determine whether democracy and freedom will prevail. It's that simple. It's that serious. And the power is literally in your hands. History is in your hands. Not hyperbole. It's in your hands. America's future is in your hands. Let me close with this. Nowhere else in the world could a kid with a stutter and modest beginnings in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Claymont, Delaware, grow up to sit behind the resolute desk in the Oval Office. That's because America is and always has been a nation of possibilities. Possibilities. We must never lose that. Never. Kamala and Tim understand that this nation must continue to be a place of possibilities, not just for the few of us, but for all of us. So join me in promising your whole heart to this effort. For me and my family, there's a song that means a lot to us, that captures the best of who we are as a nation. The song is called American Anthem. There's one verse that stands out.
And I can't sing worth a damn, so I'm not going to try. I'll just quote it. The work and prayers of centuries have brought us to this day. What shall our legacy be? What will our children say? Let me know in my heart when my days are through. America, America, I gave my best to you.
President Biden, Monday night in Chicago. More thoughts, no doubt, on the DNC as the week progresses and on our roundtable discussion on tomorrow's broadcast. So let's take a quick break here. We'll come back with Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial. You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. We're running late.
Yes, no time for chit-chat.
Yeah, thanks, Joe Biden. Our latest Green News Report.
So yesterday was a pretty devastating day here in Connecticut.
Another round of rain and deadly catastrophic flooding, this time in Connecticut. Climate change dramatically increased the likelihood and severity of record wildfires last year, new study finds. Plus,
he literally promised big oil companies, big oil lobbyists, he would do their bidding for $1 billion in campaign donations.
As Democratic National Convention gets underway, climate and environment groups endorse the Harris-Walls ticket.
All of those endorsements and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have under our feet more liquid gold. I call it oil.
Everyone calls it oil, you idiot. Except maybe the Beverly Hillbillies. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, well, another Democratic National Convention where it would seem the Democrats would have a lot to crow about when it comes to climate this year.
Yes, they do. The Democratic National Convention is underway this week in Chicago, beginning with celebrating President Joe Biden's landmark policy and climate achievements, including restoring and updating critical pollution and emissions laws and standards, the CHIPS and Science Act, his infrastructure law, and the historic Inflation Reduction Act signed 2 years ago this week. Vice President and Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has suggested she will continue Biden's pragmatic transition to cheaper, clean energy and his policies building infrastructure resilience to accelerating climate impact, policies that are also restoring manufacturing jobs to the U.S. Last year, companies committed to investing more than $300 billion in new domestic manufacturing projects under laws that zero Republicans voted for. Canary Media reports that in the first half of this year, private and public investment in the clean energy sector alone hit a record $147 billion so far.
You know, there is a lot of investment under the Inflation Reduction Act, and it's going to be a number of years before we really understand how broad this investment actually is in clean, renewable technology. And I just wonder how much credit Joe Biden will get down the road for all of it.
We will see. The Democratic Party's platform on climate, pollution, and energy is a stark contrast to Republicans who still downplay climate impacts already costing the U.S. billions in losses every year and who have voted in lockstep against policies to address it and mitigate the damage. Republicans vow to expand fossil fuels that drive climate change and repeal clean air and water regulations that rein in pollution and climate warming emissions. Plus, GOP nominee Donald Trump still denies climate change is a problem. The two climate and energy policy pathways will result in starkly different outcomes with consequences for Americans' health and the economy for decades to come. So it's not surprising that climate and environmental advocacy groups citing Harris's long record of climate action have universally endorsed the Harris-Walz ticket, seeing her as an ally on addressing environment and climate issues and a chance to build on Biden's success. Here's climate advocate Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson on NPR.
This is a race between dangerous climate denial on the one hand, Trump, and just climate solutions on the other with Kamala Harris.
Meanwhile, the climate hits just keep on coming. A state of emergency in Connecticut and Long Island, New York, where an intense storm over the weekend, not related to Hurricane Ernesto, dumped more than a foot of rain in just hours, triggering flash floods that killed at least two people and destroyed transportation infrastructure. And in North Carolina, even though Ernesto was 1,000 miles away, it caused coastal flooding that washed away homes. Rising heat from man-made climate change also drastically increased the likelihood and severity of record wildfires in 2023, according to a groundbreaking comprehensive review of global wildfire activity published in the journal Nature. The researchers concluded that climate change made the extreme fire weather conditions last year twice as likely in Greece, three times more likely in Canada's record fire season, and made fires in the Amazon rainforest at least 20 times more likely.
Unbelievable.
A different study warns that parts of Canada's boreal forest are burning faster than they can regrow. But there is some good news. The Biden Environmental Protection Agency is moving swiftly to push funding from the Inflation Reduction Act out the door before the November election.
Good idea.
The agency announced Friday it has locked in an additional $27 billion in climate funding, walling it off from Republicans who say they will repeal the law if they take majorities in both houses of Congress and the White House in November.
Get that money out the door. Don't assume that Kamala Harris is going to win. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. We got to keep moving.
Yes.
Thank you very much to our producer, Desi Doyen, and all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program or any other, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button or go straight to bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me an email. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And you can find me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site, yes, still known as Twitter, at TheBradBlog. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.